Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy Crane. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and this is another episode of Improv Nerd. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Thanks for listening. We have a great show for you today. We have Edgar Blackman as our guest from the Second City main stage here in Chicago. But before we get to that, as you've been listening to this podcast, I'm sure you know, I'm very close, very, very close on purchasing a home with my wife. And when I say a home, I'm talking about a three-bedroom townhouse in Evanston, which is a suburb north of Chicago. And if you're like me and you're at home and you're listening to this, or you're in your car, or you got it on your what do they call those? The thing that you stick in your ear? I can't even think. I was going to say, I don't even know what it is. So you're listening to it on it, and you're thinking, my God, how can Jimmy, he's an improviser, he's a teacher of improv, how can he afford to get a house? So my natural reaction would be, I'd be very, very jealous. And then I would take the next step and I would turn it on to myself and say, what am I doing wrong? So I'm going to share you this little story to give you a little backstory on how I can afford it. The other day I'm at this meeting. It's all men. We're sitting around a table. And I tell them that I'm about to purchase a house. About an hour later, the meeting's over. Guy comes up to me, very conservative guy. He says, hey, how can you afford a house? You just tell jokes. And I said, I can afford a house because I have a very well-off father-in-law who's very generous. Now, if you're like me, you'd be saying, oh my God, I'm even more jealous of Jimmy because he has a father-in-law who's giving him a lot of money to buy a house. And if you're like me, my dad doesn't have any money to give me anything. So I would be even more jealous. I don't know if that made you guys feel better or feel worse, but I just wanted to share that with you. I'd also like to share with you this interview with Edgar Blackman. And Edgar, it was such a fascinating interview because he is one of the few people that I know that got hired at Second City Main Stage, and he exclusively studied at the Second City Training Center and Conservatory. That is such a rare thing because most people, as you know, they're either studying at I.O. or The Annoyance, or they came from New York where they studied at UCB or The Pit, and then they get hired at Second City. Edgar is a African-American actor, so we talked about race, which I always think is just a very interesting and at times can be a scary topic. And the other thing I thought was he was incredibly vulnerable as he talked about the death of his sister, which was still fresh in his mind after about 2 months of her death. So I think you're really going to enjoy this episode.
Jimmy Crane's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh yeah.
All right. Okay, so you grew up in Richland Park,
yep.
Okay, which is a south suburb of Chicago.
Yes.
Your mom's a minister,
uh-huh.
And you said she taught you life lessons through the Bible.
Yeah.
Can you give us an example?
She's just like, so anytime I would have a problem, my mom would be like, well, let's see what the Bible has to say about that, which is a really frustrating feeling.
So you would like...
I'd be like, oh, mom, this girl doesn't like me. And she'd be like, let's see what the Bible has to say about that. Like little things like that. My mom... while like my verse game is not very good.
Verse game, meaning?
Like, I'm not gonna cite like Leviticus right now. That's kind of how she was always like trying to help me work through my struggles in life. It's like, well, you need to understand that there's a reason for feeling that way, and there's a divine purpose for the thing that you're going through.
And then you said that your dad was tough.
Uh-huh.
And how does someone who comes from a tough household become funny?
My dad's also not fun. Like, he's funny. Okay, so my dad is funny in a way that his effort towards comedy is constant. Like, he's always telling me jokes, even though the jokes aren't always hilarious. Like, uh-huh. You know that the nacho cheese joke?
No.
All right, so there's a man that's sitting in a bar. He's got a giant wheel of cheese on the bar. And the bartender's like, hey, man, what kind of cheese is that? And he's like, oh, this is nacho cheese. And he's like, oh, well, how can you tell it's nacho cheese? And he was like, oh, well, it was rolling down this hill, and this guy chasing it was like, that's nacho cheese, that's nacho cheese. So that's a joke that my father told me. So, like, I'm telling you, like, the joke may not be hilarious, but the fact that he's telling me a joke is important.
So were you like one of those kids that were funny at home, or not funny at home, and more funny at school is a release?
Yeah, I think I was probably funny in both places. I was always trying to make my family laugh and make other people laugh, almost as like a defense mechanism in a way. And then also was like...
What was the defense mechanism?
Well, it was very small. I skipped kindergarten. Like, I'd been reading since I was like three. And okay. So we get to kindergarten, and they're doing like alphabet stuff and word things. And I'm telling my parents, like, oh, I'm crushing it in kindergarten. Like, we're reading this story. There's letters, and I already know what all the letters are. And I'm like, I'm always done with my homework first. I'm going to get the milk. Like, I'm just hanging out in there. My dad was like, hang on a second. You doing that well? Let's see what the first grade has for you, champ. So he, my father came to school and was like, I don't think my son needs to be in kindergarten anymore. I think you need to put him in the first grade. So my birthday's in April. So I don't even turn the year that everybody else turns until the end of the year anyway. So like when I graduated high school, I just turned 17. So it was like, and I was also very short. So I was like 4'6" when I was in the fifth grade, and break 5 feet till I was like the end of my freshman year. So I'm using comedy to protect myself from getting pushed around. And then also in a way, like if you can get everyone laughing around you, then other people won't fuck with you. Can I say fuck?
Yeah, you can say whatever you want.
Other people won't do that because they're like, don't fuck with Edgar, man. He's cool. He's funny.
And then you got to high school, but you were afraid to do theater, right?
Yeah.
What was the fear there?
You know, there's a thing about doing theater that I think, as somebody who already felt as uncool as humanly possible, like, As a tiny, like, acne-covered trumpet player whose voice was, like, kind of hadn't changed and changed and it still sounds like this, that I was like, well, theater is going to be... I mean, because we didn't even have, like, theater. We just had musical theater. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, that'll be the death knell for any like, ever kissing a girl in this school ever.
Right.
And it's like, but it was, like, what I enjoyed doing more so than, you know... trying to not.
But then you did get cast in high school as in Bye Bye Birdie.
Oh, that was in the eighth grade.
That
was quite a windfall for me. just imagine watching Bye Bye Birdie and like the heartthrob of this show. You can't see a lot because when he comes through the crowd, he's smaller than everybody. He's this tiny fake Elvis, like the acting job these young ladies had to do to swoon over me was fantastic. Woo! Look at him! But my voice
and
hadn't
they're
changed
like tall, like
I mean,
a foot
they're like,
taller.
They're, like yeah. they're in the eighth
it's
grade.
It's like you're going through like, the forest.
Jesus.
Yeah.
But I was the one that could hit all the notes at the point, so I was like, yeah. So I did that, and that was fun. It was fun for me. And so when I was in high school, I did The Wiz. I think when I was a sophomore.
Was your school racially mixed?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It was like it was about 50-50 when I was there.
Okay.
It's way blacker now, though.
And what does way blacker mean?
It means that all those, as the school became more 50-50, all of my friends' white parents moved to whiter neighborhoods.
How did you feel about that? Because you probably had white friends, right, that were moving because of... Mm-hmm. How did you feel about that?
You know, I wasn't raised in a household where things like white flight weren't understood. Mm-hmm. I know what that is. Mm-hmm. Whatever, man. Listen,
were you hurt? I'd be angry at their parents.
I mean,
I'm like, well,
you're
racist.
But like, what are you gonna do? Like, I'm gonna hate my friends because their parents want to live around more white people. Like, that's not.
I would have just hated the parents. I would have still been friends with it.
Yeah, man. Whatever. To me, I don't feel. That doesn't make me feel like they're bigots. that makes me feel like they're comfortable living in a certain kind of neighborhood. Now, if you are uncomfortable around a lot of loud black children running through your streets on their bikes, then maybe you should move. But I feel the same way. Like, if I were to live in a neighborhood with like a bunch of like ruddy young white kids with you know, Confederate flags off the back of their bikes, I'm fucking moving too.
All right. So how did you get into improv?
I did a little bit of improv in college.
In Rochester.
And then...
Now, you didn't start out being an acting major in Rochester, did you?
No, you go to the Rochester Institute of Technology. There is no acting major. The closest you can get is a communications degree and an acting club. So that was when I first did improv, and then I didn't do it again until I took my first class at Second City, which was Improv for Actors 1.
And then when you get there, what I find is amazing is you actually then get hired by Second City.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
I did Improv for Actors 1 and 2, and then I did the conservatory, which was like fantastic. And then right after the conservatory, I auditioned for Brown Co.
Which is, for people that don't know Brown Co.
Brown Co. is like is Second City's outreach and diversity company. Mm-hmm. So at the time, that was like, that was them being like, we admit there's not a lot of black people in this building. Right. We need to find more of them.
So we're going
to
call it Brown Co.
So we'll call it Brown Co. It'd be really funny. And it was like their joke. People were like, aren't you offended? I'm like, no, man, that's cool. Right. So I did 4 Brown Co. shows, 2 a year. And then...
Because that's all we can take in.
That was like, right. Well, it was a really long process, actually, right. For the amount of money we made. So yeah, I did 2 shows a year, and those shows ran 8 weeks apiece. And then I auditioned for the touring company twice, and that sound you hear is my child. Like, somebody fired? I'm like, no, that's baby.
Is your child here?
Yeah, my husband.
And your wife is here too?
Right there,
oh my God.
Where was I? The conservatory. And then Brown Co. And then, yeah, so I auditioned for the touring company, I think either 3 times or twice. And then I was an understudy for the touring company, and then I toured with Redco for a year and a half.
But there's a story before that where you're working at Cars.com.
Yeah.
And you had said no to Second City a long time.
A ton of times.
Now, nobody says no to Second City.
Nobody.
Nobody does. How did you get the courage to do that?
Okay, so you were talking about my father earlier. And so my dad is from North Carolina.
Okay.
He's a very sweet human being, but he was, like, my father was training he was building like a man, and I say that in like the most old-fashioned-y way of like country way of that.
Give me an example of how.
So like my dad was like, "You're 9 years old, mow this lawn. You're allergic to grass. That's not my problem. Mow this lawn." And like at the time, even at 9, I was like pushing it like this, like it was that big, because he was conditioning me to not be like a pussy. He was like, my little pussy son will remain a pussy if I let him. And I would. I'd be like writing in my journal and crying all the time. writing notes to girls and never actually asking them out, right. Shit like that. And he was like, no, man, I gotta get this out of you. So when I worked at Career Builder for a while, and when I was working at Cars.com, and I remember getting asked to do shows in like Atlanta, and they asked me to go on a cruise ship once. Like Beth asked me, like, would you do a cruise ship? And I was like,
Beth Kligerman, yeah. From Second City.
Yeah, and I was like, no, because I had family. I had,
at that time, you were married, and you.
I was married. My son was like 3. Mm-hmm. And I just I couldn't exist in a world where like that I couldn't shoulder that responsibility properly. So I was like, until there's a way for you to put this in front of me in a way that I feel comfortable with, I can't do it. I have to find another way to get there. No. Here's my water. but yeah, so it came to a point where they asked me to, and I, as much as I love being at Cars.com, and the people around me were great, I fucking hate that shit. Just made me sick inside. And so, when they asked me to do this this city-specific show in Philadelphia for 3 weeks, it was like 3 straight weeks, My wife was like, how many more times do you think you can say no to Second City before they stop asking you? And I was like, I don't know, man. I don't know. We're probably getting close to it, though. And so between that, it was a woman that was my boss at Cars.com. Her name was Tanisha Hooper. And she gave me this book, and she was like, it was Tony Dungy's book, and it was just talking about, like, just being on the right path and following this path and not being afraid of what comes next.
Well, isn't Dungy a Christian?
Yeah.
Okay, and you're a Christian,
yeah.
Right? Okay.
And so she was like, she's like, sooner or later, you're going to have to just believe that God's going to put you in the right place. My wife said the same thing. So I quit my job at Cars.com. I go to Philadelphia for 3 weeks.
At that point, you're thinking, well, God, you know.
Like, we got 3 weeks of money coming in. When we get back, we just gonna find another job. They're always hiring for salespeople in the city of Chicago.
Right.
But right before I left for Cars for Philadelphia, Beth asked me to replace Mark Roderman in Redco. So when I came back, I went right into touring.
So you're touring. Your wife is, if I'm not mistaken, she's in school to teach, right? Mm-hmm. You have a child, mm-hmm. and you get $80 a show.
Yeah.
$85. And what is the meal stipend now?
Oh, like, man, I don't know what it was, boy, but
okay,
I was getting that per diem. I was making that shit work.
How did you guys survive? How did you survive on that?
Man, God is good, man. You just believe in God, man. He'll take care of you. You don't have to believe in God. That's up to you. But for me, I always felt
I want to believe more in God.
I always felt like my wife and I, so many times we'd be like, well, man, I don't know. What's this? This might be it. And then just something happens. We'd get like another gig would come through or a situation would change and we would make more money. I only toured, you know, like to do that Philadelphia gig twice, that's making more money in 3 weeks in one gig at Second City than I would if I was just like touring during that time. Mm-hmm. So even those kind of things, just they just keep you afloat and you just continue to pull yourself up.
I want to just say something about God and faith for a second.
Okay.
Because I struggle with believing in God more and stuff like that.
Okay.
And the thing about faith, and I was talking, my wife actually, she's much more spiritual than I am. Mm-hmm. It's about taking action, isn't it? Like people mm-hmm. think, oh, God is just going to come into my...
So lazy.
Right. But you really have to take that act. That's where the faith is, right?
You already got, I mean, to me, the life you have that isn't even yours is a gift. Like just being here is a gift. So don't spend your time not, you know, thinking like, oh, when are you going to give me all this stuff? Like you got all this stuff already. So you spend your time pushing back and giving.
It's interesting. When you speak about it, you're very emotional about it.
Yeah.
Recently, you experienced loss mm-hmm. with your sister. Mm-hmm. And before that, you guys lost a baby, didn't you, in 20 weeks? How has your faith helped you with loss? Because it...
I think, you know, okay, I'm just going to cry. So let's just let this happen. I'll stop fighting it. I believe that we are all connected, every single one of us, through our spirits. And that is why I do the job that I do, because I feel like there is so much to be said spirit to spirit, and it is a very beautiful way to do it when you do it through comedy. Some people do it through music, some people do it through art. The gift that I was given is this, so this is the gift that I use to get this message out. So when I think about this baby that we loved, we never got to see open his eyes, when I think about my sister, I am saddened and heartbroken by the loss of them. I am also emboldened by their spirit that I carry with me at all times. And so it is also very lazy to me to think that because of this pain that I have any right to then fucking stew around and not get things done, like almost because of their loss and their inability to continue to do work in this world, I have to be twice as good.
Did you feel angry towards God?
No. No. I don't really get that way towards God. I ask a lot of questions. I think that if you are a spiritual person, that's fair to want to know more. My life is filled with so much joy on a daily basis. It would be so selfish to me to think that I have any place to be mad at God when there are so many gifts in my life on a daily basis. I can be sad that things happen, but even the things that have challenged me the most, like losing my sister, that sadness hurts. But there is even a joy in that. My sister lived a tortured life.
In what way?
She suffered from mental disease. My sister lived in a world where, at times, she could convince herself that even the passing traffic was in some way someone plotting against her.
Was she diagnosed as schizophrenic?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So at times when she was clear, and you know, more so this happened later in life, but as a child, you know, she's my sister, she's fucking fantastic. And then as time goes on, you think, can we reverse the effects of this thing? Will one day I be 45 and my sister will be 43 and it'll be like this age in our lives never happened? But there's a peace that God gave my sister that I don't think I could give. And I also think that it's very bold for me to believe that I could force that change in her spirit and in her heart and her mind. And that if what comes of her death is the release of her mind and her spirit to a more tranquil place than the world that she lived in on Earth, that's okay with me.
Let's switch gears for just a second.
Okay. Guys, improv nerd is getting deep.
We like it.
Let's talk about Jesus and our place in this world.
So you've done three shows on main stage.
For real though, can I get some water?
Harrison, come on.
I'm gonna be sucking these ice cubes down, right?
This is not my moisture.
The first show you were in was South Side of Heaven.
Yes, sir.
And in that show, you do this sketch called Baseball People.
Mm-hmm.
For people who haven't seen it, tell us a little about that show.
Okay, so South Side of Heaven was a fantastic show for someone to come into Second City and be new as a cast member. Billy Bungross was the director, who I actually went through the conservatory with. Joyce Sloan passed during the process of that show.
Mm-hmm.
So that also meant a lot. We wanted to make sure that we did something that that respected, excuse me, the legacy that she would leave behind. Thank you very much. And so Baseball People, to me, that was a scene that I wanted to do. I was like, if you only get one crack at the main stage, you make sure you get this one out.
So the
idea behind Baseball People is I wanted to find a way to call white people niggers and make them feel it. So I used baseball as that mapping device. I said that the Cubs are the niggers of baseball. So the fun thing about this in Chicago is that the fan base of the Cubs is going to be, you know, largely by percentage more white than the fan base for the Sox because of the locations of these parks. So for these lovable losers, I was like, let's call these people niggers and see how it makes them feel. So to me, the Cubs are the niggers of baseball for these reasons. They never really win. Everyone loves to hang out with them, even though you may not be a real Cubs fan. And if they did win, we would all fucking be at that party. But if you were from another city and the Cubs beat you in the World Series, you'd be like, I can't believe we lost to the fucking Cubs. And that's how I think that people feel about Barack Obama. They're like, this nigga went and won the fucking, I can't believe it. And they have tried to call that man a nigger in every way without saying it from the beginning of his run for presidency, to the even to this very single day. They're like the fact that I when we did the last show, I had a woman yell at me from the audience, "You're not an American," as I was doing a Barack Obama impression. I was like, for the fact that that even became the president of the United States had to show us his motherfucking birth certificate, to me is an absolute insanity. So we wrote this scene where the Cubs and the Sox, these two, I come in and Sam Richardson is my brother.
Now Sam is black. Just
Sam
for
is
the
also
audio
black.
Back.
Yes, which is great because there's no way I can do this scene if Sam's not there.
Why?
Because then it becomes one black man in a room full of white men doing this thing. It's like 3-on-1. What it allows me to do is be the character that says, "Y'all the nigga base nigga kill yourself." I call Tim Mason a nigger in that scene.
And Tim is this Tim is tall, like, white,
Dave Matthews band.
Right, like, yeah.
couldn't be more Irish, you know what I mean? Like, he's so beautiful. He's such a
you
great man.
You just called me the N-word.
Yes, yeah. And he's so sweet about it. So there's that energy. There's Tim Robinson, who's like, can we all just not fight and say these words? Right. And then Sam, who is going, Sam is going to play your more mainstream African-American man. He's going to play an educated African-American man. He's going to essentially play us. He's playing myself and he's playing himself. I am playing this other black dude that I now get to do because I'm now not just this one thug black dude in a sea full of white men. There gets to be two black perspectives in this scene, one of which is mine and one of which is Sam's, which protects me to say the things that I want to say. So kudos to Sam.
Did you get any pressure? I mean, because Second City, it's a lot of white tourists that go there. Mm-hmm. Did you get any pressure from management
Nope.
or the director?
Not
or
once.
What about people afterwards, Sam?
Mm-mm. I think people want to be challenged. I think that we are afraid to do it to them.
Now, let me tell you something that I did. And I feel a little ashamed about this, but Norm was directing a show I was in. It was called God Show.
Okay.
Tim O'Malley, who was a teacher of yours, it was
Absolutely.
About his.
I've seen the show.
You saw the show?
Yes, sir.
Did you see me in the show or not?
I think Gelman was playing your part that night.
Okay. So there's a part where I have to come out as a character that Tim was in rehab, and it's a black character. So I'm a white guy playing black hair, and I have to say the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I would.
It was definitely Gelman who played your part.
Okay, great. So every time I'd get off stage, and I would feel, you know, and it got laughs and whatever, I would feel a bit ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
What's your feeling on that?
I mean, you're a white man, dude. I don't know if there's a way for you to say nigger and feel, especially portraying a black man.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way for you. I don't know how you could do that and not feel a little bad, right?
I felt when I would get off stage and I would see black people in the audience. I wanted to avoid them because I thought they would confront me.
I say faggot in the show we're doing mm-hmm. right now, and I say it for a purpose. I'm not playing, but if I was playing a gay man and I had to say that word a lot, like in a show, if that was the part I was playing, I think saying that word a lot makes me feel uncomfortable. The reason I say it in the show that we're doing right now is because I know that that word makes people feel uncomfortable, and I want them to feel uncomfortable when I say it.
So the line is, we can never really figure out this line, can we?
Hmm. I think if you make it funny enough, you could probably shit on a person's face and get away with it. For lack of a more elegant way of saying it.
There is going to be a lot of people that listen to this podcast, and they're going to be doing that in improv. I heard Edgar. Edgar said, yeah. Either that or I'll make it an exercise in my classes.
Hey.
Let's improvise.
Okay.
What do we want to take? A location, a relationship? How do we want to start?
Let's get a relationship.
Great. A relationship for Edgar and I.
Doctor patient.
Okay, now, I hear doctor and patient.
Right.
All right? And the first thing I go to is a doctor... into the, a doctor's office.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, how are we going to get mileage off that?
Okay. In a doctor's office?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good question. How are we going to get mileage off that?
First thought? When
the
you're
first thing I think when I think doctor-patient is psychiatrist.
Okay.
Patient. Is that weird?
Okay, let's.
That's the first thing I think.
Okay, psychiatrist, great.
All right, but I mean, also, you know, we don't have a location, so I think we could be a doctor and a patient at a ski resort.
Okay, great.
For real, yeah. Mike?
Yeah.
Take a seat.
Just going to go to the slopes.
Well, before we go to the slopes, there's just one thing I want to get off my chest, and then we're going to do this. I understand this is very important to you.
Yeah.
We're going to cure this fear of ice.
Okay.
But there's a couple things that I want to just get off my chest.
Okay.
Do you mind?
No, not at all. You're gonna sit.
We're gonna sit close. Is that okay?
Well, usually when we're in the office.
I know this was, but this is an out of office situation. So like in the office.
New boundaries.
No boundaries here.
No boundaries.
No boundaries. I know. This is important to me.
Okay.
Your evolution is important.
No, I understand this. But we have boundaries, and boundaries make me feel safe, and I don't feel safe right
Mike,
now.
Mike, I'm gonna take some steps back now.
Okay.
I'm gonna take some steps back.
Okay.
Okay, that was a push. I pushed you.
Okay.
You pushed back.
Right.
I accept that.
Right. Did you? Okay. Cool. Great.
You don't have to take a seat.
Great. That's reverse psychology. Of course I want to take a seat.
All right.
All right.
Mike, I want you to embrace today.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
And I want you to embrace today with an open heart.
Okay. Breathe.
Okay.
Your chair just made that
sound. I know. I did not pass gas.
Okay.
That's a chair noise, and it's okay for you to feel weird about it.
No, if you would have passed gas, that really would have, that would have made you human. And I don't see you as human.
You don't?
No.
Would you like me to pass gas?
No, I'm just saying this.
Okay.
This is totally new territory.
Yes, and I know that this is a very, this is experiment.
Yeah.
Okay? Not a lot of psychiatrists take their patients out on the slopes to cure their fear of heights.
Right. And I'm thinking to myself, maybe I should have gone with the first thing you suggested in our last session was doing a ropes course.
Right.
But I'm going to stay with this because this is where we are.
And I want to be here with you.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Here's the deal. Your sister and I are dating. Now...
What the fuck?
Yes. I know you're surprised by this.
I'm totally surprised by this. Why didn't you tell me sooner?
Well, you see...
Well, your sister...
What? Your sister's a little wobbly, right? And so I was like...
But she's wobbly, so...
Just psychologically.
I know, she's on medication, so what?
All right, so here's the thing.
Wait a second, now.
I'm going to take some steps back, because I see I'm doing something... Please.
You talk... Told me I needed to be more...
No jabs.
It's an invisible knife.
Okay.
You told me I needed to be more aggressive, and then I've been sitting on my anger.
Yes. Yes! Okay, this is good. This is good. Tell me how you feel. I'm dating your sister, and I didn't tell you because I thought that, that she was, I might break up with her. I didn't want to.
Why are you dating with my sister or you're breaking up with her?
I'm not breaking up with her.
Good, because I come from a broken family.
I understand that. And that's why I was a little worried about your sister, because I was like, a girl from a broken family, she's probably going to be fucked up, right? But this is the thing.
She was. Your sister's great.
That's enough. Your sister's great, Mike. Okay? She's great, and you're great. You're great.
You told me you'd never date a white girl.
I told you that I would never date a white girl again, is what I said.
When I came in, and I said, you know what? There's this girl at work. This black girl, Charisse, and I really like Charisse.
Right.
I really like her.
And
you said, you better be watching, you better be careful.
Be careful.
Because interracial marriages that people stare at you, and they're not a problem.
That's true.
And that's what it is. And now you're going out with my sister.
That's absolutely true. But you and Charisse, that would have been weird. But it's a black lady and a white guy, everybody stares. When it's a white guy and like an Asian girl, they kind of stare. But a black man and a white girl, nobody sits at that anymore. It's all the time.
Fake night.
Good.
No, I don't want to hug now, okay?
You sure?
I'm positive. I don't mean, I'm so fucked up right now, I don't know if this is a session or a dream or I'm on acid.
No. This is life, Mike. Now here's the deal. This is the last thing we're gonna do together.
Are you killing yourself?
No, no, no.
I mean, you've thrown a lot of shit at me in a long, short period of time.
Yes.
I've seen you for 4 years, and I've known more about you in the last 8 minutes than I did for 4 years.
Yes. You're going to learn a lot more about me.
Oh, my God.
You want to take a seat?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't want to...
All right, not yet. I'm going to move this seat here. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, like I said, Mike, we've worked together for 4 years together.
Yes.
I think that you've made a lot of progress.
Thank you.
What I want you to know is that when we go down those slopes, this is going to be not just a release of your fear of ice, but a release of your fear of brother-in-laws.
I'm a little confused.
Yes, and you should be. We are going to go, we're going to ascend the top of that hill.
The bunny hill.
That's right, as Dr. Patient.
Okay.
And we're going to slide down that hill. And when we get to the bottom of that hill, we're going to be brothers. Because I'm going to marry your sister. That's why we're doing this here, because, okay, so get ready for this. Your sister is here, in a different suite.
And my sister's here on the premise?
Yes, she's here on the premises. Now, after we slide down, I thought we could all sit down together. We're going to get married right there. And then I will no longer be able to be your doctor because you'll be my brother-in-law.
You know, this is weird. Can I just say this? The last couple minutes, and I don't know, you sounded a lot like Barack Obama.
Did I?
Yeah.
You know what it is? It's when I, this, it's right here. It's right around here.
Uh-huh.
If you hear that?
Yeah.
You hear that tone?
Yes.
That is the Barack Obama key. It's a key that makes most Caucasian people feel at home. Not too deep. Not too high. You don't want it too deep, then you're gonna feel threatened.
Right.
Too high, then you're not gonna feel my blackness. So I want you right here in the middle. Right?
Okay.
How does this make you feel?
I'd like to be the best man.
Ooh.
Yeah. I think I've known you for a long time. She's my only sister. I think it would be only appropriate.
Do you think you could handle that, Mike? Do you think you could handle being the best man?
Yeah.
We've talked about your issues with speaking in front of groups.
Yeah.
And there is the very obvious fact that you barely know me as far as a personal aspect is concerned. But here's the thing. I think that's a great idea.
Okay.
Now, I am going to tell you, you are going to be in charge of the bachelor party.
Yeah! Yes! Yes!
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That's, well, you know this? You hear that voice? That's brother-in-law voice. You hear that?
Yeah, I like that. Voice. Yeah. I like that.
There's still work to be done.
Okay.
You want to sit down?
Yeah. So, I'm in charge of the bachelor party.
That's right.
Okay, so what I'd like to do is I'd like to have a stripper.
A stripper? Is that what you're coming up with right now?
Yeah.
A stripper?
What I'd like.
You would like... Okay, okay, all right, great, that's great. Well, a stripper.
I'm sensing that you would like more than one stripper.
I feel like, you know, if I'm gonna marry your sister, you know what I mean? I feel like I wanna see a lot that night, you know? I wanna see like a whole, like I don't feel like I've ever seen a Vietnamese woman's breasts. That's gotta happen that night, because this is it, this is my last chance.
We can do that, okay?
Okay.
We'll get like 4 or 5 strippers.
I want like a NATO of strippers.
And that's a done deal, okay?
This is working out.
Okay. Since you're my brother-in-law.
Not yet.
You're my doctor. Mm-hmm. And I brought this up, this issue about getting late, because I'm still a virgin.
Okay.
I would like you to...
I thought I told you in our last session to just go out and buy somebody some drinks
and asked them a very direct question, would you like to have sex with me today?
I did that.
And what happened?
I got slapped in the face.
How many times did you do it?
I did it once.
Well, see, that's your problem. That is a very dire approach. It's like, that's like jumping out of an airplane and then chasing the parachute as it's falling in front of you, grabbing it, strapping it to yourself, and then pulling the ripcord. Like, the opportunity is very small, but you have to keep doing it over and over again. So the next time, I want you to do like 10 people.
The next time, we'll be at the bachelor party.
Okay. Yeah, I like where you're going with this, Mike. So we're going to get you late. I feel like this is going to work out. I don't know if I have to stop being your doctor. I think that might be a better way to get you to where you want to be.
I think you're absolutely right.
Wow. I should date more of my patient sisters. I'm just kidding. Your sister's the best. She's the only one for me.
I didn't think that was funny.
You didn't think it was funny?
I didn't think it was funny.
It was just a little joke, Mike.
I never
Mike.
Had a brother, okay?
Mike.
You know that.
That's what brothers do. We
you know I'm sensitive. I haven't been able to have a job in like 5 years. This is going to be hard for me to get used to the brothers shrink relationship.
All right, here's what we'll do. Let's make it clear, because we need to set some boundaries. Boundaries make you feel safe.
Oh, now we're going to set boundaries.
Well, I think we're going to break some boundaries down.
Okay.
But anytime you break a boundary, you have to build another boundary around it.
Yeah. Okay? Isn't that a fence?
Yeah, but the boundary is for what's inside.
Great.
Okay? Imagine that all of your rage is like 15 gallons of water.
Okay.
All right? And these gallons of water are in an invisible box that sits in front of you.
Okay.
You have this invisible box in your heart. And then you take that box out and you expand the boundaries. Now more of your water can have more places to go. Okay?
Aren't you just going to get wet?
Yes. But that's why they're called tears, because we do get wet.
Oh.
Yes. Okay? Now, here's what I want. Here's what I want.
Okay. What is that? Because I've never seen that.
You see, this is what I'm doing here? I'm pulling your energy into me.
Okay.
All right?
Okay. This is
This is an exercise that I learned on Hopi Reservation.
Okay.
Now feel with me.
Okay.
Reach forward. Can you feel it?
Yeah.
How does this make you feel?
Kind of stupid.
All right. Now touch my fingers.
Touch your fingers?
Just with your fingers.
Oh, with my fingers.
Mm-hmm. All right. Feel that?
Yeah.
That's your brother right there. Yeah. You ready for this? Ready?
Yeah.
You ready for this?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Uh-oh. Here we go.
I don't know if I'm ready.
Oh, yeah. Come on, grip. Put your fear in your grip.
Okay.
Here we go.
Okay.
You like that? Here we go.
That's cool.
Here we go. Here we go.
Okay.
Now, wing. Now you're a free bird. Open it up. Open it up. You're a free bird.
My heart is opening.
You're soaring. Come here. That's right. I love you, Mike.
I love you too.
Now,
I need a little love break.
Is that a lot?
Yeah, it was a lot.
You feel like you can ski?
Yeah, I can ski.
It's time, buddy.
Can I just say, I love you too. I never said that before.
Really?
Yeah.
You never told me that?
No.
Well, thank you. I know it means a lot. Now, what I want you to do, is grab those skis.
Those skis? Got them?
And we are going to cure your fear of ice.
Because that's what we came here for.
That's right.
Thanks, brother.
You're welcome, bro.
Oh my God.
Fun.
That was a lot of fun.
That's fun.
So let's talk about it. We knew immediately that you were the therapist, right?
Yes.
And I went to Low Status, which I love playing.
Fan.
And I loved it. I got tired in some of the parts. Did you?
You mean like physically tired?
Yeah. Well, just like it almost felt like a marathon, didn't it?
Yeah, you know what? There is like there is a feeling of when you do a scene that's that long. Mm-hmm. I think that there is a point where like you get to a place in it, and then you say, "All right, we did that," and then you know this is like in a if we were doing the set like at Second City, we'd be like, "All right, that would have been lights." All right, right, now what's the next evolution of this relationship? Okay, mm-hmm. That would have been lights. What's the next evolution of that relationship? So in those lulls, like I think the cool thing is being able to kind of just like play patient, give each other a gift, see where that gift takes right. us. And we talked about a lot of things between, you know, your character and mine went through a ton of emotion. I think it was fantastic.
Yeah.
But I felt that same way. Like when you
like the Barack Obama thing? I mean, you did sound like Barack Obama, and I'm thinking, okay, that's great. But that's kind of that's my first thought.
Right.
So how do you think, like, okay, so you're sounding like Barack Obama.
Yeah.
So do I just call it out, or do I try to make it more... It didn't seem like it for me. I wish it was a more sophisticated move, I guess.
Oh, I thought it was a fun bit, right? Okay. I mean, yeah. Like, we're not going to look back on that scene and be like, oh, that was the scene we did about when you had that Barack Obama voice.
Right.
But it's a fun thing that, like, if you were really my brother, you would say that to me. My brother-in-laws tell me stuff like that all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, there are, I mean, and plus, even when I did the Barack Obama impression, I was so hard on myself because there's a part of my voice that gets there easily. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I'm like, you're not working hard enough to do this impression, but it doesn't, I'll slip into doing that. I'll just start sounding that way just because of how close our timbres are.
Right.
But like my brother-in-laws tell me that I look like Rajon Rondo all the time.
Who's Rajon Rondo?
he's a basketball player for the Boston Celtics. And that was a bit that we did in the show. But like we did that bit in the show and my brother-in-laws hadn't seen the show. And they just had noticed because of basketball that I kind of resembled him. Mm-hmm. And they would do that to me all the time. Hey, what's up, Rajon Rondo? Mm-hmm. So that's what people that care about each other do. They make fun of each other.
Great. So let's. We got a lot of people here. They want to ask you questions. So
okay.
Let's turn the lights up. And great. Who's got a question? Right here.
What's up, man?
What's going on?
Do you guys know each other?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've talked a couple times.
Okay. What's your name?
Rich.
Hey, Rich.
Nice to meet you. As an improviser of color, going through like classes and like independent teams, everything like that, for me, there's always that type of, you know, where does, you know, presenting, you know, my viewpoint and how things that I find funny or that I want to talk about come in and not necessarily clash with other improvisers that are white, per se.
Mm-hmm,
There's kind of like that little boundary where I feel like, you know, how are they going to take this? Were there like any particular times where you were kind of like, maybe I should throttle back because I don't know if they can take this? Or...
I think what you feel is right. I think that there's always going to be, I guess, a sort of a disconnect between where your life experiences are going to be different. Like when I was on tour and I'm in the car and I'm like, yo, let's listen to this Clips mixtape. And I'm like, everyone else is like, no, thank you. You know, that's a difference in the way that we come up. It's, you know, there is going to be, especially in this world and in the improv world, there's going to be a certain level of education that you're going to have to do to your castmates in a certain extent and the audience that you deal with. It's like, your Waka Flocka Flame jokes ain't going to fly on the main stage. Nobody's going to be laughing because that artist is going to be like, who's Waka Flocka Flame?
I was just going to ask you.
Who's Waka Flocka Flame?
Like, as I'm a white guy.
But yeah, so like there's, and I think the gift is in the same way that everybody comes from a different place. So your job is to bridge that gap. And it may be harder for you as someone of color with, you know, five white male actors from the Northeast around you, but you can bridge that gap. You just have to explain exactly what it is you're talking about and why you think that that's funny and worthwhile, which is the important thing.
Great. We got time for a couple more questions? Yeah, right here.
Yeah.
What's your name?
My name's Blake.
Hey, Blake.
Nice to meet you. You seem to be definitely one of those improvisers and, at that level really shown like you're real. You're very real with a lot of your passions, with your family, your friends, what your interests are, your spirituality. Like, how does that translate so much into your comedy and into your sketches? Because I remember one of my favorite sketches of all time was Sauce at Heaven. Heaven.
Okay.
That was amazing, I thought.
Thanks. I would say that that's like, our director Matt Hubdy, and when we started this process, said, he gave us this quote that an actor stands naked before the world. And so when, especially in improvising, when you write these things, you really have to open your heart up and allow yourself to be as vulnerable as humanly possible so that the things you're the most passionate about can come out. So if you want to do your comedy from this place of safety where you get to like stand on your hill and throw jokes down at the people beneath you, then like that's all you'll ever be. If you really want to get something done, you have to open your heart and start connecting with people. So I'm like, sometimes in that scene that was hard to pitch. We just lay it out there. We did this scene in heaven. There's a section of it that references me meeting up with that child that we lost. I wrote that scene like right after we lost that baby. But it's like, that pain, that's not the only person that carries that, and it would be selfish of me to not share that with somebody and allow them to have a little bit of release at the same time.
How much is that, doing that scene, healing for you?
And it's also nice for me to be able to share that emotion and for me to exhume that emotion from my heart, and so that I can look at that moment with joy and not with this like transcendent misery. Makes sense?
Yep.
Sense.
Like, for example, I actually went to the Waka Flocka concert.
Okay.
And like I'm in class with Rich actually. So
right.
Like, if I in class, or I guess for anyone, and no matter what the race, but if there's something that you see you can connect on, or like, but you're kind of assuming based off of outward appearance, I mean, do you really run into like a dangerous zone there by being like, that guy, kind of like flat.
Yeah, you gotta check, right?
Yeah.
I mean, out of the people in your class, man, you don't want to judge a book by its cover, but I mean, if I was doing a statistical check of the people in your class, I'd be like, well, I would guess the only person gonna get this white flock plane jokes number. You gotta ask, right? Like, I met Ross Bryant on tour. Ross Bryant's in the show right now. We get to rap together, but we rapped on tour. And I wouldn't, if I never asked to play this Clips mixtape and not know that Ross is into rap music like that, then maybe we would have never connected, and that we would have. I mean, but seriously. But that's how you just have to keep reaching, keep connecting. You'll find things that even aren't those like surfacey things. In the main stage, my friend Holly is... Holly Loren is a very spiritual person as well. But she's a white woman from Michigan. I mean, there's not like a lot of like outwardly things that would make us be so excited to work together, but there are a lot of things that are beneath the surface that she and I are on the same place with.
Are we too polite with this race stuff when it comes to comedy?
No, I think that it's a real sticky wicket. It's one of those things that you really have to make sure that you're paying attention to. I think that the other problem is that race is such a dangerous tool to wield, and that tool is wielded by fools and idiots all the time, which makes it seem not as right. Like, people will just do shitty race jokes, black people, white people, and that devalues sometimes the work of it, and then makes us feel like, oh, I can't say this because I'm going to get looked at as being this person. But when you look at like Louis C.K., he talks about race as a white man, and he talks about it in a way that's like, if you're a white dude and you think you're not making it, you shut the fuck up. Like, that to me is his perspective on race. I don't think it doesn't hurt my feelings. I think he's saying what he thinks is right, and I think he's hilarious. And the way he says it is hilarious, because it all comes down to this. If you're funny enough and it says something, you can basically shit on somebody's face and get away with it. Guys, let this be the thing you learn.
That's a great way to end. Thank you, Edgar Blackman.
Thank you.
It was fun.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerd. I'd like to thank our guest today, Edgar Blackman from the Second City main stage here in Chicago, and the good people here at Stage 773, our home base. We love you guys. You're so nice and kind to us, and we just love you. And as always, my producer, Ben Caprero. I'd also like to welcome to the show, we have a sponsor, Hotel Lincoln. They are in the heart of Lincoln Park here in Chicago. If you get a chance and you need a very reasonable place to stay, it's improv friendly, check out the Hotel Lincoln. And welcome, Hotel Lincoln. as a sponsor. For more information about my award-winning classes and workshops, and I have some intensive workshops, if you are going to be in the Chicago area in July, go to jimmycurain.com, and you can also see my improv blog there as well. And if you like what we do here on Improv Nerd and you're like, oh, I want more, please, please, please go to our Improv Nerd fan Facebook page and like us. It's great for my self-esteem. And my therapist actually said, the more likes I get, the more improvement he's seeing in my mental health. So check that out. Thank you so much for listening. We've been getting some great comments and feedback from all across the country and all the improv communities. So we want to just thank you for spreading the word, because it's been a great almost 2 years on Improv Nerd. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island, yeah, and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
It might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you fuck.